high-impact local water providers and how citizens can reduce water usage and protect water quality at home. But first, I'm Natural Lee, and I have your environmental news. California's Division of Oil and Gas and Geothermal Resources on July 7th issued cease and desist orders to seven energy companies, warning that they may be injecting their waste into aquifers that could be a source of drinking water. The action comes as California's agricultural industry copes with a drought crisis that has emptied reservoirs and cost the state $2.2 billion this year alone. The lack of water has forced farmers across the state to supplement their water supply from underground aquifers, according to a study released this week by the University of California, Davis. The problem is that at least 100 of the state's aquifers were presumed to be useless for drinking and farming because the water was either of poor quality or too deep underground to easily access. Years ago, the state exempted them from environmental protection and allowed the oil and gas industry to intentionally pollute them, but not all aquifers are exempted, and the system amounts to a patchwork of protected and unprotected water resources deep underground. Now, according to the cease and desist orders issued by the state, it appears that at least seven injection wells are likely pumping waste into freshwater aquifers protected by the law and not other aquifers sacrificed by the state long ago. Experts say that aquifers the states and the EPA once thought would never be needed may soon become important sources of water as the climate changes and technology reduces the cost of pumping it from deep underground and treating it for consumption. Indeed, towns in Wyoming and Texas, two states also suffering long-term droughts, are pumping, treating, and then delivering drinking water to taps from aquifers, which would be considered unusual under California state regulations governing the oil and gas industry. The decision of the Nuclear Regulatory Authority, or NRA, to approve the draft assessment for the two Sendai nuclear reactors in Kyushu is a clear and dangerous signal that Japan's nuclear village, industry, regulators, and government is deliberately and cynically ignoring the lessons of the Fukushima nuclear disaster. The approval of the assessment is the first step in restarting the Sendai reactors. The two Sendai reactors have been shut down since 2011. These reactors are old, 29 and 30 years respectively. The citizens of Japan know that the Sendai reactors are not safe to operate. When the NRA announced it was putting the reactors at the top of the list for the review, 6,000 people demonstrated in Kagoshima near the plant. According to an opinion poll by Greenpeace Japan, less than 10% of the people living within a 30-kilometer radius of the Sendai nuclear power plant think they can evacuate without being exposed to radiation if a severe nuclear accident were to occur. The major issues of concern at Sendai include no effective evacuation plan for the populations in the region, no functioning emergency response center protected against radiation, and the failure of the Kyushu Electric and NRA to conduct robust assessments on volcano risk. As we approach the one-year birthday of no nuclear-powered electricity in Japan, the last of the country's remaining 48 reactors were shut down in September 2013, it is clear that Japan can function as a society without risking catastrophic nuclear accidents while rapidly growing its renewable energy sector and embracing efficiency. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is awarding $2.1 million to 37 organizations in 17 states and Puerto Rico to help protect and restore urban waters, improve water quality, and support community revitalization and other local priorities. The Heartland Conservation Alliance in Kansas City will study 3,000 vacant lands in the Middle Blue River watershed for the purposes of identifying properties to redevelop with green infrastructure or low-impact development. This effort will build upon current work for developing a Blue River watershed restoration strategy. The goal of the project is to improve watershed health and community vitality. Blue River Watershed Association, with its partner agencies, will create and engage 8 teams of underserved community youth by involving them in water quality monitoring studies, data collection, and community presentations and projects. Each team will include a high school youth coordinator, an educator, and a mentor who is a professional in the field of water quality, environmental stewardship, engineering, biology, or similar field. Students will share their connection to the watershed with others through presentations and community projects designed with each team. And now I'd like to turn over to Elaine Giesel.
Thank you, Erin. And you are listening to Eco Radio tonight. It's interesting that your last item, Erin, was about protecting our water here in the cities, because tonight's topic, and we're going to be covering a broad area, is about water. There are several things going on in our region that we want to talk about, from the federal laws down to regional planning and what you can do in your backyard, because summer apparently is going to arrive tomorrow, I think is the date. I mean, from a weather standpoint, we've been very lucky so far this year. And water is a complicated issue. One of the phrases being used right now is water energy nexus, and I'm beginning to hear that everywhere. But it could also be the water energy food nexus, the water energy food economy nexus. And the point is that all of these elements are connected intimately and in a very complicated fashion, so that when you start managing one, you invariably impact one of the others. And what we see here in Kansas, where and I'm going to be focusing primarily on Kansas tonight, because I work with the Kansas Sierra Club, but I do want to say that because of the nature of watersheds in general, that we all live downstream of someone, and whether you live in Missouri or Kansas, many of the things we're going to be talking about tonight will apply to you. But in terms of regional water planning, that's going to be specific to Kansas. But what I would like to start with actually is looking at federal law, because there is a proposal that has just been put on the books fairly recently to look at the kinds of waters that are to be under the jurisdiction of a federal law called the Clean Water Act. And this is why I've invited here an attorney, Lee Cross, is with us. And he, although he is involved primarily in civil litigation locally, he has been working on issues of air and water quality with Sierra Club, particularly out in western Kansas where water's pretty scarce. So, Lee, the Clean Water Act, would you say it's been a success in the last 40 years?
I would say yes, Elaine. Good evening. Thank you for having me. It's been a tremendous success, and one that has paid dividends mainly on the coasts that suffered greatly from industrialization, more than a century of industrialization before the Clean Water Act was finally codified in its current form in 1972, but also in the Midwest, where it allows us to have relatively clean water for fishing and swimming in.
In fact, that is the basic goal of the Clean Water Act, was that all the waters of the U.S. would be fishable and swimmable. And
yes,
that's an interesting phrase. That sort of makes it very clear what we're trying to do here. And we mentioned the term watershed. What goes on upstream is ultimately felt downstream. So since western Kansas is upstream, it's higher in elevation than where we are situated now in eastern Kansas or Missouri, then water flows downhill. So the Clean Water Act has to address issues throughout the watershed. Now, what are navigable waters? Can you tell us from a legal point of view what constitutes navigable waters? Because that originally was the jurisdiction that we had over protecting water.
Well, and as you know, it's a tremendously controversial topic, what is navigable and what is not. But generally, anything that had a tide or the ability for a water vessel to travel upon it was deemed navigable, or anything contributing to a river or water source large enough to have a boat on it.
Right, and that was in its natural state before it was dammed. I mean, there have been a lot of court cases to deal with this. I think there is confusion. I hear it, when I talk to people, that the Clean Water Act only applies to navigable waters then.
That's right. Many people think that. I think certain interests would prefer that was so, but over the course of reviewing the legislative history and histories, frankly, that went into the Clean Water Act and each statute, really going back to the Federal Water Pollution Act, Control Act of 1948, each statute's got legislative histories, and then the courts, of course, get to interpret it, a statute. And so it's pretty clear from the commentaries and legislative histories and then the decisions on the statute that it was intended that the Clean Water Act apply beyond just the navigable waters, so that it applies to connecting waters or any kind of water or frankly, circumstance is going to affect the quality of water in the main public waters of the United States.
Right, and that's interesting, the public waters, that what goes on upstream and might impact some of us who live far away. And there have been court cases since about 2001 that have had a lot of impact on trying to determine what waters constitute waters of the U.S. And as I understand it, the newly proposed rules that EPA has filed in the Federal Registry were meant to clarify and
yes.
not extend, you know, the authority, but to clarify what waters were covered.
Well, and yes, thanks to you and material you asked me to review and my general background, there have been any number of cases that have sought to clarify what exactly it is that the Clean Water Act applies to. So a famous case in 2001 decided that isolated waters that are not traditionally navigable or interstate, nor tributaries thereof, nor adjacent to any of these, can be regulated by the Clean Water Act. And then again in 2006, essentially the court ruled, I think it's somewhat of a step back, that there had to be a significant nexus, like with a wetland to a river, in order to allow the EPA to regulate it. So the new rule, as I read and understand it, is really just the seeking of clarification for what the Clean Water Act applies to. There's still a number of exemptions for agricultural use, and really just, if anything, working to give more certainty to businesses and agriculture what is and what is not covered by the Clean Water Act.
And this issue of jurisdiction really does have great implications, because then federal law that covers water quality protection standards and infilling of wetlands, which we've lost well over 50% of the wetlands and natural wetlands in Kansas already, those then come under the jurisdiction of federal authorities and the federal law. So it's not a trivial issue at all. And not surprisingly, we're seeing pushback from different interests. Water is used by everybody, whether it's for drinking water, for irrigation, for transportation, recreation, by wildlife. There are a lot of conflicting uses. And we're seeing particularly, and I would call some of it fear-mongering, it's certainly fear, within sectors that feel that there has been an overreach by EPA to try to regulate waters that have not traditionally been under the Clean Water Act. And my concern is that, you know, how do we educate the public that this is not new, this is clarification, that we can work together
right.
on this. We all need the water.
Well, I think, if I may answer, that's an issue that plagues a number of us that care about these issues. And how is it that we approach it and work to inform people that it's more than just interfering with business, right? I mean, it is what the statute set out to do, to make the water swimmable and fishable. And then many of us that particularly live in a city, we don't have a chance to do that every day. So what does it mean to us? How does it impact us? Well, we need to drink it. We need to bathe in it. And, of course, we have wonderful water treatment facilities that help us accomplish that. But these are issues that go beyond that, and, frankly, we have to spend a lot of money to get water clean that I think maybe nature intended to be at least more clean than it is. And if I may, throughout history, one of the things that, as a student of social science, that has always intrigued me is that any kind of body of water has been, at least at a minimum, a supplemental food source for a community. And so we have, of course, wonderful grocery stores and places where we can buy meats and farmers markets, but we lose, or theoretically and potentially lose, and have harmed wildlife in these bodies of water that humans could otherwise consume.
Yeah, absolutely. And the fact that we don't have new water. The water we use has been around for billions of years, and it's constantly reused, recycled, so we have to take care of what we've got. And as the population continues to grow on the planet, what's interesting is that water demand is going up almost twice as fast as the population is going up. And part of that, as we'll come back to in a minute, is probably related to providing the kind of food that more and more people want to have on the planet. So we're dealing with a very complicated nexus of food, energy, and water, and economies. I would recommend to listeners who find discussion of water law not terribly exciting that this is a hugely important field, and that if you want to know more of what is being proposed, and we're going to see a lot of information, I think, in the media about this, there is a comment period that is currently open until October 20th. Individuals can send notes, you know, email or written letters to EPA, and you can voice your opinion on whether this is a good thing to do to try to protect the waters of the U.S. and extend it upstream into our headwater streams, our wetlands, areas which have served to function as natural water cleansing systems and make it cheaper, ultimately, for those of us who need drinking water, downstream users. But it does put us, in a sense, and maybe literally on the other side of the fence from an agricultural economy where water quality protection is perhaps not viewed as high a priority as having water to grow your stuff, your quantity issue. We're going to come back to that in a minute when we talk about the vision for Kansas and having water for the future. But by Googling EPA and the Clean Water Act, you will go straight to the page that you need, and they will show you what's going on. There's a good frequently asked questions piece there, which gives specifics on what the new proposed rules are meant to clarify and what waters are exempt. There tends to be, I think, in my experience, a knee-jerk reaction where the ag community figures, you are now going to try to regulate my stock ponds and the ditches in my backyard. And I even had a quote from one of the ag magazines that basically said, Uncle Sam was coming into your backyard to tell you how to use your water. And that is just not the case. And I would encourage listeners, go and educate yourself. You can talk to your representatives about it. I think there's going to be a big fight before October 20th. I think in Kansas in particular, we're going to see downstream water users of surface water polarized against the interest of the ag economy.
Well, and if I could add to that, the comment period that EPA has opened up, frankly, under criticism, is unusual. It's 180 days, 182 days perhaps, by the time it closes on Monday, October 20th. So there really was a concern from EPA to make sure they heard everyone in this process. And then, just if I may, Elaine, just add a few things that are going to be included under the new rule. And a lot of it is just based on science that come to us from communities in the university sector or any number of different scientists and certainly interested groups like the Sierra Club. Most seasonal and rain-dependent streams are protected. Wetlands near rivers and streams are protected, and that's critically important for our society and state because it usually wetlands usually help protect in floodplains and other areas that would flood in times of heavy rain. And other types of waters may have more uncertain connections with downstream water that you keep referring to, and protection will be evaluated through a case-specific analysis of whether the connection is or is not significant. So that's the critical language from the U.S. Supreme Court laid out in 2006, that there has to be a significant nexus to a main body of water, and you're shaking your head, and I know you know this, but a lot of our folks don't. So when the strident rhetoric hits the media in terms of the EPA is going to come in and tell us how to regulate our ditches, we're talking about bodies of water that have a significant nexus to waters of the United States. And again, the main point is, and thank you for letting me go on, point is just to clarify what is covered by the Clean Water Act.
And I think, too, the proposal is explicit in that it does tell the ag community what will be covered and what will not, what will be exempted. And some of the very good practices that are being implemented on some of our ag lands to help improve water quality and reduce erosion. The NRCS is working on that. And those kind of projects will not require the permitting of infilling and permits and so on that other projects would. I mean, there have been explicit exemptions based on good practices, best management practices. So
on a case-by-case basis.
And I think there are some specifics in the proposal that has been published in the Register. And I will tell you, the Federal Register is like 90 pages of definitions and exemptions. It's not a fun read. And we're not going to go into that on the air. So we have this federal process ongoing, that the point of which is to protect water quality for all users, upstream users in the agricultural communities in Kansas, as well as those of us who live in the eastern part of Kansas. And that's one reason, listeners, that I've invited someone from one of our water utilities to talk to us in a minute about how this is going to impact all of us who drink water, bathe in water. And in a way, sadly, we use the same water to wash our cars and water our grass. And we're going to come back to how we can be better at conserving potable water sources as they become scarcer. So I want to ratchet down from the federal level to the state level, because there's a huge process now engaging in Kansas, not Missouri, but that will, we hope, provide long-term water resources for Kansas. It's called the 50-Year Water Vision for Kansas. And in the development of this document, this vision, was requested of the Kansas Water Office by Governor Brownback. And there have been a series of stakeholder meetings that were held, I think, in April. And just recently there was a road tour. The Kansas Water Office and the ag folks came by to tell us about the vision for Kansas. For some of us, the vision is a little short-sighted, I must say. And we did have an opportunity to make comments. There is, despite the fact that the Water Office has made this nexus of energy and water explicit in its own water plan for the year 2014, there's no mention of energy needs and water in the vision, which is the same agency, and I let them know that. That was an issue. Did you have something, Lee?
What do you mean by that? No mention of energy?
No mention of the amount of water currently being used for energy production or may be used in the future, and that would include water used in thermoelectric facilities just for cooling, including a nuclear plant on Wolf Creek, ethanol production, and the water used for ethanol fracking, and the water that is disposed in deep. None of that is even touched on in the vision. And it seems to me when the agency says you can't address water management without talking about energy, and then they don't talk about energy, there's a problem. So we've certainly made that comment. One of the biggest issues are the agencies in Kansas that manage water. And, Mandy, you were asking me out in the lobby, how many did I count? Have you ever counted them?
Thank you.
Seriously.
I want to say thank you for having me to you. And to
I'm glad you're here.
You know, I think it numbers in the neighborhood of, I think, 8 state agencies that have something to do with regulating water in Kansas. And, you know, to the extent that there can be efficiencies there or, you know, perhaps enhanced collaboration, I think it's a good time while water is center stage to take a look at what we could accomplish by, you know, coordinating some of those interests together at the state level.
Absolutely, and perhaps more transparency and availability of information for the general public. I put my League of Women Voters hat on for a minute and say it's kind of hard sometimes to find out who's on first base. And if you really have a question, deciding whether it's a Kansas Water Office or whether it's KDHE on water quality, whether it's the Department of Agriculture that is, you know, in charge of appropriating waters, whether it's a Kansas Corporation Commission on the disposal of waters, who's on first, and how do we have public input into those problems? Lee, I want to go back to some water issues here. Kansas operates under a senior rights appropriation process. And I don't want to go too deeply. I don't want to lose my listeners now, but basically what does it say?
It's what's known in the legal community as prior appropriation, and it has its roots in its history, our history of being a western semi-arid state, and the vast majority of, majority of Kansas is west of the 98th meridian, which means that there's less than about 15 to 20 inches of rain west of that that meridian. It's about Salina west. So in the eastern Kansas, we get about 25 to 35 inches per year. So it's critically important that when someone acquires a water right, that they use it for the better interest of a market or for a community so that we can use the land in the most efficient manner. So goes our philosophical and legal theory. So Kansas has operated under that system for all of our history. We still technically have it, although the legislature in 2012 recently changed the law so that this doctrine does not apply to groundwater rights in areas that are close to new appropriations. And what that means is that more people could acquire, or fewer people could acquire more water rights, and it's increasingly necessary when we have large-scale confined animal feeding operations or major utility expansions in places where there's frankly just not the rainfall to sustain it. So the Kansas legal history of prior appropriation is critical, particularly in the West, but also in the East, because we need farmers to have the water that they need and be able to use it. And then Kansas, as a result of all of this and the scarce resource that is water, has a complex web of control and regulation in the state. Water is a resource in Kansas dedicated to the use of the people, but the state gets to control it and permit it. And once that water right is created, it's a real property right that people have as a part of their title to the land, but it is severable where the water is to be used. And a new appropriation right can be obtained by applying for a permit. And then once that permit has been issued by the Kansas Department of Agriculture, Division of Water Resources, it has to be perfected by diverting and using the water for an authorized beneficial purpose. And
it gets complicated. But I will say Governor Brownback did change some of that language where if you didn't perfect it in a certain time, you didn't arbitrarily lose it, so water could be put into conservation pool. And that was one very positive thing I think we have seen. And the vision does include some comment about maybe having to modify water law, which is interesting. We may see this senior rights business modified a little. Before we go to announcements, I wanted to bring up one thing that we're hearing a lot about in this water vision, and that is a proposal to revive the Kansas Aqueduct concept. In 1982, the Corps of Engineers apparently looked at taking water from the Missouri River and taking it all the way into western Kansas, storing it in a reservoir out there, and then distributing water. The issue is that the Ogallala Reservoir, the aqueduct, has been drawn down to the point that I think the number is now no more than 50 years of usable reserves remain if we don't seriously reduce pumping out there. And it is the largest freshwater aquifer in the world, some say. And over the last 50 years, we have been pumping it far faster than it recharges naturally. I think it's a horrible ratio, you know, 1 inch to every foot or something of recharge to a foot of or more of pumping. So the idea is to bring in water through an aqueduct. And there are some who find this laughable. I mean, hauling water from the Missouri has political implications because I understand Missouri is the one river that really hasn't legally delegated certain amounts of water to the states it goes through. So there is still the ability to get rights from the Missouri. But I'm not sure our neighbors are very happy about giving up that water. The barge community here has not been happy about not having enough water to float its barges on, although I understand that for the first time in 10 years, a barge went up to somewhere like Omaha this week, and they celebrated the occasion. It's not like there's a lot of traffic on the river. But there's also the cost. And we were talking earlier about aqueducts made by the Romans took water. Mandy, how did you put it? Go ahead.
I think with concept is the obvious word here. I think that there are geographic challenges. Kansas's topography slopes from the west down towards the east, and that is a situation that is different than where these major aqueducts have been successfully implemented elsewhere in the country, further west. And so we would have a geographic challenge to overcome. There would be, you know, the funding and financial challenge to overcome. The intrastate politics and the precedent setting, operational issues, as well as, you know, you got to consider the farmable ground that would be taken out of commission for these major reservoirs in northeast Kansas and southwestern Kansas. So there's a lot of hoops to overcome. It's an interesting concept, but a lot of hurdles between here and there.
Yeah, some of the numbers that they would pull water from the Missouri River upstream of KC. Put it into a reservoir roughly 375 miles away. I think the Utica Reservoir was one that was originally mapped, and that there would be a rise of about 2,000 feet in elevation, which means you have to pump water uphill for 375 miles. The cost in 1982 was something like $3.6 billion. We think it ought to be probably double that now, if not more. Some estimates have gone as high as $12 billion to get water out there. And again, this is water to be used for agriculture, for pivot irrigation, primarily of water-thirsty corn, which is not eaten by humans, is used for ethanol or for CAFO feeding. And you have to ask yourself, is this the right way to do things instead of trying to conserve the Ogallala? Why don't we break for a minute, give people a little break. We'll have a couple of announcements. We'll come back and wind up on the vision. And then I want to talk to Mandy about what you can do about this at home.
This Tuesday on Radioactive Magazine, Janet Rogers of Transit Action Network discusses the 10-year, 3/4% Missouri Amendment 7 transportation sales tax with Sheila Styron of Whole Person, Linda Smith of League of Women Voters, and David Kingsley, a retired UMKC professor. Can they answer the question, why vote no on the state sales tax for transportation when there is such a huge list of projects to complete? That's Tuesday night at 6 p.m. on Radioactive Magazine, 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Maybe we ought to start thinking and acting like we're in a moment of crisis. You know why I think we ought to start thinking and acting like we're in a moment of crisis? Because we're in a moment of crisis, y'all. And look, it is true. It is an ecological crisis. It's not coming. It's here and going to get worse until we interrupt it.
Tune in to the next forum where we'll hear from lawyer and political activist David Cobb as he discusses everything from corporations to human rights, only here on 90.1 FM, KKFI.
Wednesday at noon.
Dr. Thomas Stockman has made a disturbing discovery.
Do you know what they really are, these beloved baths of ours into which we've poured our blood and money? Do you know what they are?
What are they?
They are nothing but a damned cesspit.
Richard Kind stars in Henrik Ibsen's An Enemy of the People. Next time on L.A. Theater Works.
Hear the full performance Wednesday evening from 7 to 9, followed by chamber music.
This week on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
Contrary to the myth in our culture that we separated an individual, aggressive, competitive creatures, we're actually wired for empathy, wired for connection, wired for love, wired for compassion.
I'm Neil Harvey. Please join us for Inner Resilience with Dr. Gabor Mate on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
Friday morning at 9:30, right before Eclectic.
This is Elaine Giesel, and you're listening to Eco Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Tonight we're focusing on water and the issues that, particularly in Kansas, that are impacting the people of Kansas. We're going to go back briefly to our conversation about this Kansas water vision, and you do have an opportunity, by the way, to submit some comments to the Kansas Water Office on this. They have not given us a deadline on that, but their own timeline shows by the end of the year having something to give back to the governor. So I would get those comments in by the end of August, early September. They're still meeting with groups, but you can go to the Kansas Water Office, look at, you know, the vision. It's right on the front page, and you'll be able to find a place to enter your comments. I'd like to go back to Lee because there are some legal hurdles involved in this, the new vision, and there are some basic premises as well. So, Lee, close us out on the water vision.
Yeah, just to frame it, at its core, the vision does not focus on long-term water quality or sustainability. It only focuses on primarily on private profit in the hands of who currently controls the water rights. And so there's any number of issues that we need to address. As you mentioned earlier, the water that is used in energy production and what that means to our farmers, large-scale or small, that if we were to move, I think, put more money into research and development of alternative energies, that the current usage for coal or any number of utilities uses so much water that if we put alternative energies in place, we could have more water to grow food for an ever-growing global population. And then there's going to have to be changes in laws to allow for interbasin transfer and to make sure that we have good quality of water for a state that is now majority urban. It is critical that we have good water quality to use in our cities. And then, you know, I think our neighbors in Missouri, not only for barge traffic, but they need to be quite concerned what's coming their way. And that we're not using it up or giving it to them in some sort of unusable format for our neighbors and farmers in Missouri. So there's any number of problems with it, and I thank you for the opportunity to talk about it.
Well, it's not a huge document, actually, and I think those who are interested, take a look at it. There's a fairly good summary of the various areas and some of the very specific things you don't have to be an expert and comment on, but there are some things lacking in the terms of protecting wildlife habitat and the minimum stream inflows, as I mentioned, the energy piece of it. So take a look at it and deliver some comments to the Kansas Water Office, because this is the future of water in Kansas. I want to move now to my other guest, Mandy Colby, and she is with Water One of Johnson County. And she's going to tell us, one, how maybe the Water Vision and perhaps even the Clean Water Act proposals might impact your local water utilities, whether it's Water One or others, and also things you can do at home to help protect water quality and to conserve water usage. So we're going to take this from the macro picture right down into your kitchen and your bathrooms before we're done tonight. And I'm sure we'll come back to this again many times. Mandy, you mentioned just a minute ago kind of the gorilla in the room here is who uses water in Kansas. Mm-hmm. Why don't you tell us?
Sure, absolutely. You know, looking at local control and local issues and local water use, I think it's important to keep in mind in looking at the statewide water conversation, evidence-based on who uses the water. 85% of water consumed in Kansas is rural. 15% is urban. 7% of water consumed in Kansas is for municipal use, people who live in cities, so us, you know, taking showers and drinking water and watering our lawns and washing our cars. And the facts really come down to if nobody ever watered their lawn again in Kansas, it would only eliminate 2% of water consumption in the state. So as the state looks at a statewide long-term sustainability plan, we're big on, you know, encouraging the Kansas Water Office and its partners to not, as we say, major in minors. Let's put the resources and attention and energy behind strategies that will really have the biggest bang for the buck, so to speak.
Excellent. And how much does an individual on the average use per day of water, say, from Water One?
Yeah, it varies. We find that our customers, you know, they use between 60 and 100 gallons per day. It varies on the time of the year and what the weather is doing. You know, this year consumption is down a little bit because the skies have been so generous with outdoor watering.
I saw a piece, a nice graph, when I was setting up for another program, that 100 gallons per person per day is direct use. That's your shower, your toilet, your watering, and so on. But that what is hidden there is there's another 1,000 gallons per day per person to generate the food that we eat every day. And that's another 500 gallons approximately, and another 500 gallons for the different fuels we use, electricity, oil, and gas. So there are these hidden uses that we don't tend to think about. When we're asked to turn off the water when we brush our teeth, I often wince because, again, the gorilla in the room is not my toothbrush. It's the ag sector using 85% of the water or this hidden 1,000 gallons per person for food and energy production. So it is complicated. Your job then at Water One is to provide drinking water.
Mm-hmm.
And where do you get the water that you start with?
Our fresh, delicious tap water comes from the Kansas of the
stuff.
Missouri River.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're very fortunate to sit at the crossroads of those two major river systems, and we see a lot of benefit in having, as we say, redundant water supplies, not just only in water quantity during dry times, but also water quality. If we're having an issue, for example, on the Kansas River with blue-green algal blooms, then we switch over to the Missouri River, and we realize how fortunate we are and how blessed we've been for some of our past leadership to have the foresight to invest in both rivers as water sources.
Water One is a little unique, isn't it? This is not a municipal utility. It's actually what? It's a it's
We are an
publicly held.
Yeah, we are an independent, nonprofit water utility. We really have a proud tradition. We started out as a private water company operating out of the northeast corner of the county. And I think through opportunity and really good long-term planning, which has always been a part of our culture, we've grown and grown. And today we supply over 400,000 people in our service area. So it's a responsibility that we take really seriously to provide good tap water.
And you actually have a kind of a democratic way of running the organization. You have an elected board?
We do. We have a 7-member elected board, elected at large from our service area. And these are people who I think are really engaged about, you know, local water supply and making sure that the utility runs smoothly for our customers.
I did say, you know, in the introduction that Aaron read, that I would ask you whether any of the water vision or the proposal by EPA under the Clean Water Act, you think it might impact whether you, Water One specifically, or any of the other water utilities supply drinking water for all of us.
You know, federal issues, we're engaged, we're aware, we monitor it. You know, the current events and activities are really affecting the ag and rural community. Where we're engaged at is making sure we represent local stakeholder interests and that we're not caught in the net of a policy or regulation that we unintentionally, you know, shouldn't be in, as well as for policies and regulations that do apply to us, making sure that it's justified and necessary, that there's not, you know, a continuing pattern of, you know, some would call it encroachment on local control. So.
And do you have rights to take water out of the rivers? I mean, does a utility have to get rights as well?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, so we have secured water rights in the Kansas and Missouri River and stay very involved and engaged in, you know, the basin advisory committees. On the Kansas River, we have an assurance district that we've invested in federal reservoirs to ensure that we have ample water supply even during dry times.
Interesting. And in the water vision, the one thing that caught my eye was relating to your operations is that there is a suggestion. These are just suggestions. No one's saying it's going to happen. But there might be funding available to help underwrite the interbasin transfers, whether they would be through an aqueduct or whether they're through some other system to connect reservoirs, that they might approach, you know, changing the law so they could use funds from the state revolving fund that actually consists of monies from Drinking Water Act from the EPA, or you told me outside that the Water One actually contributes to that.
Yeah, so state regulation is that water utilities like Water One assess a fee and collect a fee from local water users. In Johnson County, Water One customers particularly pay over $1.2 million annually in water protection and clean drinking water fees, which go to subsidize projects around the state. Typically, Water One, you know, we don't qualify for it. So there's not a lot of I would say local benefit back to the community, but it is an example of how Water One is contributing to the sustainability of infrastructure in smaller and rural communities.
Right, this is to help small communities build water treatment plants so that their citizens will have clean drinking water.
Yeah.
So it's part of the Safe Drinking Water Act, actually.
Speaking of somebody who has worked in rural and smaller communities, the State Revolving Loan Fund is a really critical funding source of low-interest loan for local communities that might not otherwise have a really viable funding source. And so, you know, in theory, if any of these future projects proposed in the vision were to, you know, spread thin resources even thinner, then it would be an impact, not particularly in Water One service area because we've had the opportunity to plan ahead and fund our own projects typically, but that would be an implication statewide that would need to be a part of that conversation.
Excellent. I mean, it's nice to know you're looking out after the people who drink your water. That's good. You wanted specifically to talk tonight about a smart watering plan that Water One has come up with. And why do we need that? And
well,
tell us about it.
You led off the hour late with talking about the Water Energy Nexus, and that is right down the lane for smart watering. Smart watering is Water One's initiative to get, you know, our customers to water on certain days of the week based on house number. What we are suggesting to customers is that if you live in an even number house, that you water outside on Monday, Wednesday, Friday. An odd number house, do it Tuesday, Thursday, and the weekend. Totally voluntary, any time of day, use what you need. It's actually not a water conservation plan since we are fortunate enough to sit at the nexuses of two rivers, but it does tap into that energy side of things. Smart watering will help us run our system greener and cheaper and better by reducing our reliance on electricity, by prolonging the life of our infrastructure, and depending on your neighborhood, it could improve your pressure too. What we're currently seeing in our system is a lot of water demand on Monday, Wednesday, Friday mornings. I think that's just human habit based on the work week. So we've got this spiky roller coaster of water demands, and it has some pretty serious implications for the lifespan of our infrastructure. So smart watering, encouraging customers to water on certain days of the week to smooth out that demand. We can supply the same amount of water, but do so greener, cheaper, better. And so we're empowering our customers with this information to see if they're open to making little changes in their watering schedule to help prolong the life of the water system.
And if someone wanted some more information or wanted you to come out and talk to them, how would they reach you?
WaterOne.org/smartwatering. Look on there. WaterOne.org/smartwatering.
Excellent, because I think there are civic groups. I mean, I work with League of Women Voters, yeah. And we've been trying to promote this as a way of, because it is a publicly owned utility. It's ours.
Yes.
I mean, and we should have some investment in that it's run right.
Yes, and I have to give credit to the League of Women Voters of Johnson County. This spring, you reached out and touched over 3,000 local people to inform them about smart watering, and so we certainly appreciate that effort. You are the real-life social network.
The League does that. Now, there's some things. Now, this would apply specifically to people who are in Johnson County.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some of the other measures that have been pushed for water conservation and water quality protection that I know that Water One has helped promote would cross state line, county lines. Tell us, how can we keep stormwater runoff cleaner? How can we reduce uses in the household? What hints do you have?
Sure. Water quality is really, really key, and it's the simple stuff that we hear all the time. You know, don't flush anything except your stuff down the toilet. Don't dump anything down the storm sewers. You take it.
That's human waste.
Yeah, that would be human waste.
Sometimes pet waste. I mean, there's some other things that we recommend to flush, and some not.
Yeah. Be careful how we define stuff.
Good point.
You know, take advantage of household hazardous waste events and prescription drug take back days. Those are all things that we encourage. On a personal note, just showing appreciation for the rivers. If you have an opportunity to visit the Kansas or the Missouri River, go down and have a picnic, fish, just, you know, take in the scenery. I think that familiarity breeds awareness and, you know, breeds a desire to want to protect these precious waters.
Absolutely. And I would say, you know, if you really want to go do a float trip on the Kaw, we've had Laura Caldwell here, and the Friends of the Kaw would be very happy to take you down the river and let you connect personally with, you know, your water. And the fact that the Clean Water Act wants to keep it fishable and swimmable. Yay! Any other things from Water One you want to talk about?
You know, we tip our hat to the Kansas Water Office for this tremendous challenge that was put to them and their partners to travel the state and get stakeholder input. And you know, I think that step one last fall and maybe a little bit this spring was give us your ideas. I think we're in the middle of step two, which is here's all the ideas we collected, now react to it. And so, you know, as you said, Elaine, you know, comment period is open, and I think that they're looking for input. We at Water One certainly are engaged in participating in that actively. And so, you know, I think that this is a really critical time for water, taking center stage, which, you know, at Water One is where we think it belongs.
Excellent. That's good to know. And, you know, there is this connection of upstream flow, mostly in western Kansas, because of the way our geography works. And those of us, the populations that live, the 2 million people, really, that live here where the Missouri comes in with the Kansas rivers, that there are implications for water quality issues. One of the comments that came up in a recent meeting I went to was that as the Ogallala is drawn down for pivot irrigation of corn for the CAFOs that Lee mentioned, these concentrated or confined animal feeding operations, that ultimately you reduce base flow to all the streams and rivers in Kansas, that it is the water table that contributes to that. And if climate change is going to impact the amount of rain we have for short-term water in our creeks and streams, there are water quality issues that can come up in our drinking water, ultimately. And I think people should understand that connection. It seems a long way out to Western Kansas, but water connects us all. It is that nexus that we're talking about. You know, I would like to thank you both for coming here tonight. Manny Covey from Water One to talk about things you can do at home. And if you want more information on this smart watering project, you've got a civics group or a church group, school group, get hold of Mandy. Tell them the website again.
www.waterone.org/smartwatering.
And they have other tips on their website on xeriscaping and fixing leaks in your toilet. You can go there and you will find it at Water One. They're a good group. And Lee, thank you for your input on the legal aspects. There are many and they're complicated. But we will ultimately have to work either with Congress on something like the revolving funds or with our local legislature in Topeka on some of this. It's complicated.
It's very complicated. And if I can add one last thing here, while only 7%, according to Mandy, of the water is for municipal use in the state, we are in a majority urban state. So a majority of the people need to be aware of how their water is being used. And though Western Kansas is a way off, the food and products that they supply to our markets that still provide the underlying basis of our economy is critical. So as the aquifers draw down, we need to be aware of how we're expending these resources and let our policymakers know.
And I think that vision is going to have to include where in the world are we going to be when the Ogallala is gone, if the ag sector in Western Kansas, if we can't find a good substitute, we lose a huge chunk of the economy of Kansas in 50 years or 60. It's, you know, it won't be me, maybe my kids, whatever. We're going to turn this back over to Aaron, who's going to tell us about some calendar, some upcoming events that you can attend, you can
yes.
participate in. Thank you, Aaron.
Thank you, Elaine.
Are you ready to do something, anything, to reduce your home's energy bills, reduce your carbon emissions, save some money? Then come to our Clipboard Home Energy Checklist Workshop. Craig Wolf and others from the HRES team will present. Learn how, why, and where your home loses energy from a do-it-yourself perspective. While it's always best to have a professional auditor analyze your home with a blower door in the works, as well as perform the work needed, there are things you can do yourself, if only you knew a little bit more. So come out this Saturday from 2 to 4 p.m. at Johnson County Library, Leawood, Pioneer Branch, located at 4700 Town Center Drive in Leawood, Kansas. The Mid-America Alternative Fuel Code Summit will be held July 24th to 25th at the Kauffman Foundation Conference Center, located at 4801 Rock Hill Road. The summit is hosted by the Mid-America Collaborative for Alternative Fuels Implementation. By the end of this two-day seminar, attendees will learn trends in the alternative fuel regulatory environment, where to find local alternative fuel codes, how to interpret and implement the codes in your jurisdiction, real-world examples of lessons learned from construction projects, and visits to various public and private installations of CNG and autogas in the Kansas City metro area. For more information and to register, visit www.metroenergy.org. After the Harvest KC is a locally run 501c3 created to get produce that would otherwise be wasted from farmers' fields to the tables of families in need. They're currently looking for volunteers at several of their farms. They need about 2 to 3 hours of your time. Please call Corinne at 816-853-4460. You can also find After the Harvest on Facebook. That's all we have for today's Eco Radio program. Hope to see you next Monday at 6 p.m.
All right. Thank you, Naturally. Do stay tuned. Sabor Latino is up next. We're going to go out with a little piece appropriate for our water program today from World Ocean Radio.
Welcome to World Ocean Radio. I'm Peter Neal, Director of the World Ocean Observatory. Our series on the new Global Ocean Commission report, From Decline to Recovery, a Rescue Package for the Global Ocean, continues in this edition of World Ocean Radio, addressing Proposal 5, Plastics, Keeping Them Out of the Ocean, and Proposal 6, Offshore Oil and Gas, establishing binding international safety standards and liability. Over the past few years, the news media has publicized the vast accumulation of plastic debris on our shores and the high seas, a function of our poor waste management practices, failed regulation and recycling, and lack of consumer awareness. In the report, the Commission states, quote, "It is important to intensify efforts to address the variety of sources of marine pollution. In particular, the Commission calls for coordinated action by governments, the private sector, and civil society to eliminate plastics entering the global ocean, including by minimizing single-use plastics by direct government intervention and consumer incentives. Creative incentives to promote recycling include single polymer products and extended producer responsibility, establishing time-bound quantitative reduction targets, achieving improved waste management, promoting consumer awareness, replicating local initiatives to restrict or ban certain unsustainable uses of plastic materials, such as bans on disposable plastic bags, polyurethane packaging, and cleanup programs, addressing lost and discarded fishing gear to avoid abandonment, encouraging XPRIZE-like innovation around substitution, waste avoidance, recycling, and cleanups, exploring taxation and other levies to establish a global marine responsibility fund to build waste management capacity, coordinate action to combat marine plastics, grow sustainability initiatives, and change the behavior of industry and consumers," unquote. According to the report, world plastic production has increased from 63 million tons in 1980 to 270 million tons in 2010, with increased production estimated to reach 540 million tons in 2020 and 33 billion tons in 2050. A large percentage of this volume ends up in the ocean, accumulating in five localized ocean areas, the large of which in the Pacific is known as the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. The United Nations Environmental Program estimates that 15% of this debris floats on the sea surface, 15% remains in the water column, and 70% rests on the sea floor, where it breaks up into microplastics over time, which enter the food chain, posing a threat to fish, wildlife, and humans. The Commission's proposal is aimed at major actions to redress this situation, but each of us can do our part at home today by reducing our plastic use, recycling aggressively, and drawing attention to individual and community actions through local boycotts, educational programs, and personal commitment. Proposal 6 addresses an equally large challenge to the ocean, well known but remaining a critical factor as offshore oil exploration and drilling in deeper and ever more remote and challenging environments continues. Some 33% of oil and 25% of natural gas consumed globally comes from underwater areas. Offshore drilling is increasing dramatically in the Arctic, Mediterranean Sea, and off the coast of East Africa. The Commission argues that, quote, "The potential impacts of offshore drilling on the environment are numerous, including the disturbance of fish stocks and marine mammals during seismic surveys, carbon dioxide and methane emissions through gas flaring and venting, and pollution of the marine environment through the loss and discharge of various substances, drilling fluids, and cuttings in particular. Fixing a problem in the midst of an accident in deep waters is particularly complex," unquote. This situation is further compounded by the variance or lack of regulation from country to country, by the absence of monitoring capacity, by the jurisdictional confusion of drilling on the continental shelf, on the high seas beyond the limits of national economic development zones, and by the failure to define and apply standards for safety, technology adequate to offshore conditions, accident preparedness response, insurance, liability, and compensation for accidents. The Commission supports the elaboration of an international convention that should, quote, "cover both economic losses and ecological damages, provide for a strict liability for operators, include provisions for a shared liability between all license holders and their subcontractors, bind states to ensure that operators have adequate financial capacity to pay for possible compensation, and set a liability cap as well as a compensation fund to address major disasters. Oil and its derivative, plastic, the base elements of the global economy. We return again and again to this management challenge. The Global Ocean Commission offers important first steps in response. We will discuss these issues and more in future editions of World Ocean Radio.
World Ocean Radio is a project of the World Ocean Observatory. Visit us online at worldoceanobservatory.org.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Están escuchando KKFI 90.1 FM Kansas City, Radio de la Comunidad.